Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, now celebrating their 125th anniversary. From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Here in Louisiana, we have more than our fair share of delectable heritage foods. Many of them are harvested from waterways in the wild. We'll venture along the Mississippi River Batcher with environmentalist Professor Oliver Hawk. Then Joey Fonseca takes us into the swamps for some wild alligator hunting. And Chef Jared Zarang shares heritage recipes from his agrarian birthplace along the River Road. We're all going into the wild on this week's Louisiana Eats. When Oliver Hauck isn't teaching environmental law at Tulane, he can often be found wandering the no man's land of the Mississippi River Batcher. Oliver gathered together reflections on his Batcher experiences in his book, Down on the Batcher. Oliver, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thanks so much, Bobby, for inviting me.
First, for the uninitiated, please explain what the Batcher is.
The Batcher is the place, as the French say, that the water beats against the land, which is why it's called the Batcher. And it's that nondescript piece of terrain between the top of the levee and wherever the Mississippi River happens to be at the moment. So in the spring, there's virtually no Batcher. The water's right up to the base of the levee. But folks are fishing for catfish, and they're in there making rafts, and they're doing Tom Sawyer stuff, and it's a marvelous ceremony. But nobody knows about the Batcher because there's so few people up there. It's just this wonderful no-man's land that runs basically from the Corps of Engineers upriver as far as you want to go. It'll go as far as Vicksburg.
You've seen a lot of catfishing going on there, right?
Yeah, there is a lot of fishing on the Batcher, and it's a little scary because the Mississippi contamination can be pretty high, and you never know because there are these what they call excursions from the industries upstream, and you don't know what's swirling down. If you took a grab sample of the river on any given day, it might be perfectly good. It would just be sediment-filled, muddy water. Boy, those industrial discharges are powerful. If you go right below the big refineries, Exxon, Shell, you're going to have some pretty dramatic bumps. And so that's where people fish.
Wow.
And basically, these are poor people, often African-American. And they're bringing these whoppers out of the water, and they're taking them home. I mean, it's like taking home a knapsack.
One of the things you pointed out that I don't know that a lot of people realize is what goes into skinning a catfish.
Well, it's amazing, and I've watched them do it, although mostly they do it at home. They'll take the whole fish home. It's easier. But there is this fellow who fishes right under the power lines by Ochsner, and one high water evening, I came down, and he was wrestling a fish out of the water. It was the most amazing experience. He had a fish in so big that if he tried to pull it out of the water on his hook and line, he would have broken the line or ripped the hook out of its mouth. It was like a buffalo in the water. He slid into the water like one of these aqua swimmer mermaids, and he just oozed his way over to the fish and started stroking it and calming it. And within minutes, he had that fish absolutely calm, nuzzling him like a puppy.
Wow.
And then he slowly slipped his hand in behind the gills of the fish until his hand was literally inside the fish's throat, still soothing the fish, the fish is still alive, sort of looking at him. And then with that grip, he could, standing in the water, he's about waist deep at that point, standing in the water, he begins hauling this monster out of the water. And when he finished, he had a very large fish out. There was a log there, and he had a hammer and a nail, And he nailed the fish to the log so that it hung down. And he slit it, and he began skinning it the way you would take off a pair of tight nylons or, you know, a wetsuit. And he just slit it down each side and pulled and pulled and pulled. It's the way I imagine young girls must get out of their jeans these days. I have no idea how they do it otherwise. But he completely turned that skin inside out, leaving the catfish there, and then he gutted it and took home the meat.
Really, Oliver, I have to tell you, I'm still haunted by your description of the unusual rabbit hunting activities you've observed.
Yeah.
Now, what's up with that?
There are a lot of wild animals in there. There are wild pig. There are coyote. There are all manner of hawks and owls. But the most common are the rabbits. And they tend to sortie out of the shelter of those woods to feed at the woods' edges and to go over the levee and go into gardens on the far side. Then they retreat back. So I was biking up there one evening, and, oh, you also need to know this. This is at spring high water, so there was very little dry land between the levee and the river. And there were just a few pieces of dry land with brambles on it, and that's where the rabbits would be, and that's where the people were. There were four of them. They came bursting out of the woods below me, the men brandishing golf clubs and chasing a rabbit who was looked like a pregnant mother. She was heavy.
Oh, dear.
The belly was heavy. And she lumbered up the levee in front of my bike and then down the other side, the men in hot pursuit. And I just put my bike between them as if I were surprised. And I was surprised. And I stopped and I said, "What's up?" And the guy said, "Hunting rabbits." And his eyes were just wild with sort of joy. And, you know, as you are now, I was shocked. And I dawdled there to give that rabbit time to get away. But I could see on the levee top pieces of fur and other things. This wasn't the only rabbit they had been after.
And they do it with a golf club.
They did, which I thought was kind of wonderful. Because, I mean, if you go back to the roots of human beings, that's the way we killed rabbits, right?
Well, Oliver,
we clubbed them.
Do you think maybe they're at least eating these rabbits?
Oh, absolutely, they're eating them.
Oh, well, thank God. Okay,
no,
that
no,
makes
I think
it all better.
Well, it makes it some better. But here's what occurred to me, and this is what I muse about. Why was I shocked? Was it the fact of a golf? Suppose they had been hunting him with bow and arrow.
Uh-huh.
Suppose they'd been hunting them with a gun. Would I have felt as shocked, offended? Wow, we've taken a big step backward, you know, was the first step thought in my mind. But no.
Well, let's move on to the dewberries, could we?
Sure.
Because this is something else I know you're a great lover of. And honestly, Oliver, I'd never heard of dewberries until you introduced me to them. So would you tell us about the Batcher character who introduced you to dewberries?
Yeah, he did it indirectly. He was gathering mulberries and probably another thing that's gone out. But this was a fellow who camped on the levee under a shelter, and he worked at a hardware store on Oak Street. So I knew who he was, and he was picking the mulberries. And he said he'd made wine out of them. So I took a few and it popped into my mouth. I don't know whether you have tasted mulberries, but they're not succulent. They have a taste, but it's a little like eating a dried fruit. And I said, "That's a little bitter, Sam." And then he said, "Well, you ought to try the dewberries." Well, I hadn't heard of dewberries any more than I heard of Merlotons. And they come in later. The mulberry come out in February and the dewberries will come out in March. And they look like a blackberry. They look like a raspberry. But they're 10 times as sweet. They're often larger.
What color are they?
Oh, they're a deep purple when they're ripe. They go from green to red, which is, in nature, red's kind of a warning sign. You just don't eat red things. And then it moves on to purple. So the trick with the dewberries is a little more fundamental. It's the picking them.
Yes.
Because they're thorn bushes.
Oh.
And inside those thorn bushes, they seem to have this symbiosis with poison ivy. They attract each other.
Oh, dear.
So poison ivy will be up in there. Also, little critters will be up in there. There'll be anole. There may be some little snakes. There may be, you know, you'll kick up some rabbits. You know, you're out in the briar patch. But here's the thing about the Badger that is important. If you were on the Badger over the levee, you're away from the highway sounds. You have the river sounds coming, but they are ancient river sounds. They're boats going by. And they go back millennia. And although you're 100 yards away from people, I mean, they're riding by in the levee top. You could throw a stone and hit them. You are as mentally away and as aesthetically away as if you were in the North Pole, as if you were in the jungle. There's this wonderful awareness, awayness. That has a profound effect on people.
That was Tulane Law professor and author Oliver Hawk, Down on the Badger. About Oliver Hawk's Bunny Badger tale put me in the mood to eat some rabbit. I know some of you might shy away from cooking Peter Cottontail, but rabbit has been an important part of Louisiana heritage cuisine since the French settlers arrived almost 300 years ago. Rabbit's high in protein, low in fat, and has half the calories of pork, so let's get cooking. Because rabbit can be a little tough, stewing or braising is one of the best ways to prepare it. To cook up a delicious rabbit fricassee, season 6 hind legs with salt and pepper and brown them in a skillet with a little oil. In the same oil, sauté some sliced onion, and when it's tender and translucent, return the rabbit to the skillet and add enough chicken stock to just cover the legs. Add a couple of bay leaves and some thyme, and then bring it all to a boil. Cover it and reduce the heat to a low simmer. In about 40 minutes, the meat will be tender and falling off the bone. Remove the legs and let them cool until you can strip off the meat and discard the bones. Then, in a heavy Dutch oven, sauté a mirepoix of chopped carrots, onions, and celery, and season with garlic, thyme, and sage. Sprinkle the sautéed veggies with some flour and stir together for a couple of minutes before adding in the rabbit's cooking liquid and its meat. Season with salt and pepper, and serve the fricassee over rice. Mmm. Rabbit fricassee is real Louisiana eats. Which part of the alligator makes for the best eating? Don't go anywhere. We'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. Which part of the alligator makes for the best eating? The tail. Inside each alligator tail are two tenderloins, considered to be the filet mignon of the gator. That and the jaw meat are best in baked dishes, cutlets, and for frying, my favorite way to eat alligator. There's also some good meat in the body and legs, but that meat tends to be tougher and requires marinating and long cooking to make it tender. When buying alligator, make sure to buy white meat. The red isn't as palatable. And here's some good news for Catholics. Just last year, New Orleans Archbishop Gregory Ammon declared the alligator could be eaten during the Lenten fasting. He said, The alligator is a magnificent creature that is important to the state of Louisiana and also considered seafood. I'd give that a big amen. I'm Poppy Tooker, and wild alligator makes for some good Louisiana eats. Joey Fonseca of Outlaw Catfish is perhaps best known for the wild Desamin catfish his wife Jeannie sells at farmers markets. Aside from the uniquely buttery-flavored wild catfish, Jeannie's offerings often include crab meat, soft-shell crabs, and alligator, all provided by her wild man of a husband, Joey. Joey, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
So glad to be here.
So September is alligator season, and I am really thrilled that you could take the time to come and visit with us. Now, what I'd like you to do is walk us through the alligator hunting process. How do you do it?
Well, suppose we paddle through it instead.
That's a deal. You got it.
Okay. The state wants us to, of course, be honest, which that throws a kink in my plans, but nonetheless, honest, and they offer us two different ways to catch alligators, basically.
Okay.
Within our said boundaries, which are all Philadelphia lawyer instructions to where you can and cannot fish the alligators. They prefer you use the hook and bait method, being less loss or possibilities of loss. They don't want to lose these big prime leather bearers.
So what's the bait?
There's feet, hands.
Stop you know. It.
Of course we're talking about chicken.
Really stinky chicken, right?
Preferably 2.5 days old. Once we're satisfied with the placement of the bait, we'll exit the scene, drift off into another area, set another one. We're going to do this 35 or 40 times, depending upon how many tags we're going to fill and how fast we want to fill them. If we're skinning alligators, which is what I've been doing the last 25 or 30 years, every year, something like that, I try to regulate myself to about 2-3 alligators a day.
Because that's as many as you could skin in
yeah,
that time.
I don't want to take on any more alligators. It would be okay if I catch all 6- and 7-footers. But every once in a while, you get these little 4-footers. And every once in a while, you get the other ones that are 6 and 7 plus 4.
So you get the little 4-foot, and that is your nuisance alligator,
well, yeah,
right?
But no, the 4-foot, it actually takes longer to skin than it does for a 6 or 7 foot because the hide's so delicate. You got to slow down a lot more.
Is there a difference in the quality of the meat from a 4-foot alligator to a 6 or 7 foot alligator?
No, but once you go to the other extreme, like 9 and 10 footers, then you would say yes. But whichever one you have, if it's cleaned properly, it's extremely palatable.
So the baits are all set. And how long do you leave them out before you go
man,
check
them? Man, I can't wait. I want to go run them now. The baits are all set. You're supposed to, once every 24 hours, come hella hurricane.
So how can you tell when the alligator's on the line?
You ask him. Mostly, you have a straight taunt line. Really good indication. We're going to play.
And then what do you do?
We dance. For the most part, a 22 Magnum pistol, preferred method of execution.
So you actually do most of your alligator hunting with a pistol. You have other things you do, too,
yes,
though,
I've
huh?
done it in several different varieties. Spice of life and all that. We take salt and pepper in the boat. First, I talked to him. Couldn't get along without it. If he has to meet his maker, let's be polite about it. Speak to him with a rifle. Speak to him with a hatchet. Gets a lot more fun that way.
But it's the blunt end of the hatchet that you use,
correct.
Right? You give him a little headache.
To say the least.
And that would be really good because then there's no hole in the hide.
True.
Okay, so you get that alligator, and
You dispatch him by some method or another, and then you got to haul him in the boat with you?
We're going to flip him in the boat as soon as we rake him from the floton. We clean enough floton out the way. We talk to him with the hatchet.
What's the floton? I don't know that word.
The floton would be the marsh that's just in the early stages of growth. And if man tries to walk upon it, usually he goes through. The alligator does support himself a lot easier on the floton. It gives and ebbs and flows.
Okay.
The man having the weight displacement only on 2 feet, if the man would probably lay down or use a push pole and walk upon the push pole, he can traverse it most of the times.
So you get the gator in the boat.
We flipped him in the boat. We tagged him because immediately upon taking, you tagged the animal. Now we can rock and roll to the next line.
And then you get your truck full of big old dead alligators eventually.
Bloody mess.
They move from the boat.
Oh, I love it.
So you move them from the boat, from the pirogue to the back of the truck, and then what happens?
I guess you could say, depending upon what's happening, we take them straight to the cooler, cool them down for 6, 8, 10, 12 hours.
So you want rigor mortis to set in for you?
Depending on what's
them?
Going on, I want to cool the hell out of them. Like I am right now with the cooler broken, I've already had to lay them down in a pirogue and cover them with ice and water, which it also does a really good cooling effect. Not long after, the animal stiffens up a little bit, some rigor mortis, I'm sure, and it makes it easier to skin. Skinning, fleshing, salting, back in the cooler and or freezer. And then once you've tagged out, go to Lafayette. I used to go to Lafayette every year. I've changed location on me now. I have to go to Bro Bridge or something. They just run me around all over the country.
And that's where you unload the skins.
That's where you sell this, and
it's a commodity. Do they pay you a certain price that's fixed?
It's considered a Louisiana natural resource. And Boy Lumber happens to be the landowner from which I deal. They have a set agreement written in paper, and there's an understanding they have so much percent. I have so much percent. And I think they deal with France.
Okay, yeah. So, I've heard that's where most of our alligator skins go.
Yeah.
So what's the best eating part of the alligator, Joey?
It's the France.
So
the edible parts of the alligator.
Yeah.
Well, I don't eat the toenails.
Okay, all right.
But pretty much
everything,
all
else?
Aspects of the meat are quite edible. If rendered correctly on the cleaning table, they're great table fare. That recipe you and I done at the Jazz Fest was quite good.
Yes, indeed.
So you should print it out and send it to all your friends.
So what is your favorite cut of the alligator? Which piece of the gator do you like the best?
My favorite cut is when the hatchet hits and it cuts his skull open.
Stop it.
And he's mine.
That is not the question.
Well,
and
I mean,
we're talking about cuts of meat.
What's normally considered the filet mignon is the tenderloin.
I mean,
certain muscles within the tail.
Okay, so it's certain muscles in the tail.
Correct.
It's the filet mignon of the alligator. Explain to us a little bit about the laws surrounding what you do. And I'm curious, have the laws changed much about alligator hunting?
The laws and how they come about. Darn, if only I was an outlaw. I would be educated and schooled in this thought. Like it is, I have to try to follow the laws to the best of my ability. And this has been, since about 25 years ago, a work in progress. Hence, 25 or 30 years ago when it first started, it was illegal to harvest anything under 4 feet. They had certain boundaries they thought they had met and come to find out. They had to erase that law because they found too many people were actually eradicating themselves at a 4-footers in order to ascertain the big boys. So now any and all alligators on a hook have to be taken, smacked in the head, dragged in a boat, and tagged, and then shot again just for safety.
Yeah. Yeah, because if you just whack them with the blunt end of that hatchet, once in a while, those babies wake up, huh?
Believe it or not, I had one jump out the boat in the shed. After we had went fishing and all, got back to the boat, to the shed. This is 2-3 hours later. That rascal had the nerve to come back alive. Jump out the boat and swam away with my tag.
Oh, yeah, with the tags.
Well, we got him, though. We went and talked to him again.
Okay. It just took some more negotiation.
Exactly.
Huh? Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time out from the hunting to come and talk with us on Louisiana Eats.
Darn, I wish I could stay.
Joey Fonseca of Outlaw Catfish, my favorite alligator hunter. Sleep. Longtime graphic designer, pop culture anthropologist, and executive editor for publishing house Tash in America, Jim Hyman provided the editing hand on the Toshin book, Menu Design in America. Jim, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thanks so much, Poppy.
So how did the menu book come about?
You know, the menu book is the result of my own personal collection of menus. It's probably at this point somewhere around 30 years that I started collecting these. Then that came from several books that I did prior to my work with Tosh. And I did a book on the history of the drive-in restaurant. And being a graphic designer, the graphics on these menus were pretty spectacular in some instances. So I started collecting these more for kind of research purposes, but then gradually the aesthetic of the menu cover really grabbed me. I just started going for it, and then it became kind of a critical mass, and this is one that he felt was definitely worthy of the large format that we put it into, because there's so much interesting stuff in these menus in relationship to the history of eating in America.
So tell us what you learned. Tell us about some of the trends that you saw come and go. What do we learn in this book?
Early on in the history of America, restaurants weren't really a pervasive element in dining at all. Most people ate at home, and hotels provided meals. And so that's probably the first instance where the public really is introduced to dining is through hotels and traveling. Now, as America grew and restaurants became part of an urban environment, then you start seeing more and more restaurants. Now, in terms of food-wise, French cuisine seemed to dominate most of the menus. There are some regional aspects to a lot of restaurants that you might find fresh game in Colorado, or in San Francisco you might have seafood or Dungeness crab, things that are really local delicacies. So you would see these appear in these menus. So it really was telling in terms of, you know, what was available locally, but also the French cuisine was something that was so prevalent and was associated with fine dining that it really dominated. Then you roll into the advent of the car, so all of a sudden you're dining in your car with drive-ins and inexpensive food. The precursor to fast food makes its appearance, so hamburgers and hot dogs. We have rationing during World War II, which forces Americans to reconsider vegetables and other things that aren't meat-oriented. And then we get into the fast food era of the 50s, where things take on very kind of quick pace with coffee shops. The drive-in restaurant is still prevalent, but it starts its descendancy. And then you start having much more interesting cuisine in terms of the sophistication of the American palate.
Something else that seemed to be drastically clear to me is that when it comes to food, apparently sex really sells. And some of the nudity you see on these menus, and it's in every decade, I think would shock a lot of people today. Talk to us about some of those nudes on the menus.
Yeah, that was one aspect of the graphics that I found really interesting because some of the subject matter that you find on some of these menus, there's some very, very provocative and salacious material on front, most of it having to do with women and nudity. So you have lots of bare-breasted women, lots of suggestive poses. Actually, one menu, which I thought was quite interesting, was for a men's club in San Francisco in the early part of the 20th century. And there's two satyrs that are dragging a nude woman, and she's tied up. And what that had to do with the meal, I'm not quite sure. I never expected to find that on a menu.
Well, Jim, those satyrs were wearing chef's hats.
Oh, well, there you go. So there's all kinds of instances of these really great pinup type women. But again, the suggestion of the nudity and so on is really, like you mentioned, follows all of the decades, so that sex did play a good part in the serving of food throughout the 20th century.
Well, on the topic of things that I think people would find shocking, I think really to people today, as shocking as the nudes might be, also some of the blatant racism issues. Talk to me about some of those just very politically incorrect things you find on those menus. And were they strictly from the South?
Oh, no. You found especially depictions of blacks really followed what was kind of cultural thing that was going at the time. I mean, the subjugation of certain racial stereotypes fell in tandem with what was going on in most of cultural references at the time. The exaggeration of facial features was very prevalent. So blacks were depicted as a very cartoon-like manner. You know, it's so offensive was a place called the Coon Chicken Inn. And not only did all of their graphics depict a bellhop black cartoon character, the actual reference was in the shape of a giant head of this cartoon bellhop. And he would walk in through the mouth of the character, and that served as the entrance to the restaurant. So there's those instances, but it's not only limited to blacks. You know, Chinese were also the object of some of this racial stereotyping. There's a restaurant in Honolulu that the entire menu is done in pidgin English. The owner was Chinese, and so he used this kind of language that is so stereotypical of Chinese. He made it a point that he emphasized that as a selling point to come to the restaurant. So the entire menu, including the items, is all done in pidgin English through Chinese filter.
Well, and so then in that post-World War II period, there's a whole lot of the yellow peril sort of imagery, too. Huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's racial depictions of Chinese being yellow and mysterious. And again, this was what the cultural norms were at the time. And so people kind of went along with this depiction. And then it pretty much evaporates, although there are still some of those images appearing into the 60s and so on. But by the 70s, that's no longer acceptable. There wasn't necessarily just one particular segment of the population that was singled out for stereotyping. It went across the board.
Do you know how the menu itself began?
Yeah, it again follows the industrialization of the printing process, so that initially most restaurants didn't have a printed menu. The menu was really on a blackboard. Originally, someone would just come and tell you what items there were. And in most cases, there weren't a lot of items. So it was easy to memorize 6 or 7 entrees and so on. And then when it became a little bit more complex, then you would put them on a board. And then once the printing process became affordable in the late 1800s, then you started seeing people having printed menus. But again, most of it was in hotel restaurants where you would find the printed menu or for special occasions. So if there was a reunion of Civil War soldiers, you would find these menus printed, and they became very, very elaborate towards the end of the 19th century with ribbons and die cuts and shapes. And for these special occasions, sometimes they would pull all the plugs out and do something really, really expensive. And they're really beautiful examples of the printer's art.
Jim, by your estimate, what's the state of the menu today? Is there anybody out there creating really remarkable menus?
Well, I'll tell you, I actually, as part of my graphic design career, I still design menus for restaurants here in L.A., so I'm just in the process of doing one right now. What has really taken over the menus is the computer. You know, people are talking about stuff on your iPhone, that when you go to a restaurant, you just go to a certain thing, and you don't even have to talk to a waitress. You just decide what your items are and send it to the kitchen. So those things are slowly evolving in the restaurant world in terms of menu.
Well, I just was fascinated with the whole topic. Love, love, love the book. And I hope all the Louisiana Eats listeners have a chance to thumb through some Tashin books sometime in the future.
Yeah, I hope so too.
Jim Hyman, executive editor of Tashin Books. When we come back from the next short break, Chef Jared Zarang explains how a box of his grandmother's recipes inspire and inform his food today. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Ian McNulty is a public radio contributor as well as a food writer for the New Orleans Advocate. He's also the author of Louisiana Rambles, an off-the-beaten-path exploration of our state's heartland. Ian, where are we going today?
Well, today, Poppy, we're starting at a place that on the map looks like it's really close to big city New Orleans, but in fact feels like it's in a different epoch of time. Okay. This is a place that is just deep down in the bayou and swamp country of southeast Louisiana. I'm talking about Lafitte. And you get there by taking Highway 45 from the west bank of New Orleans. And as soon as Marrero ends, suburban Marrero, boom, you're right into like this Jurassic age of alligators and swamps and just endless bayous. It is a fascinating transition to go that quickly from being in downtown New Orleans to being on the edge of the swamp and in this hardworking Louisiana fishing village. What I was surprised by, though, on some recent visits here, was how diverse and interesting the range of restaurants were for the day tripper or just for somebody who wants to get down there and get into something a little different in Louisiana. First off, there's a pair of places that are really close to each other, Boutis and Jan's, both sort of traditional Bayou Cajun restaurants. Now, Boutis, unfortunately, lost what used to be this great rooftop deck that overlooked the bayou. But it's still a great place for traditional seafood, gumbo, fried seafood, boiled seafood. Artichoke shrimp poppers are one special they had recently that I'd recommend. They're sort of like croquettes of artichoke and shrimp rolled together and fried.
Yum.
Of course, a creamy sauce on the side. Excellent. And Jan's across the street, basically. I mean, it's a few blocks down, if you could measure it in city speak. Very similar menu of down-home Cajun food. A couple tricks up its sleeve. One was this dish called Matthew's Special, which was, I think, chicken nuggets, but, hand-cut from the chicken, breaded up, fried, and smothered with roast beef debris gravy and cheese with fries on the side, also smothered with the gravy and cheese. I mean, just a big old plate of food. Really fun to eat. A little further down the road here, and this is all along Jean Lafitte Boulevard. It's really the only street that we're talking about down in this area, so you can't really get lost, is this find called Volio's. Volio's, it looks the part of the little down-home Cajun restaurant, and there's plenty of seafood on the menu. But there's also a sideline of German food. Turns out the owner of this restaurant, his mother, hailed from Nuremberg, Germany. And, she was came over, met a GI, and the Louisiana story was born. But across the menu here, the owner, he still maintains a little sideline of schnitzels and red cabbage and wursts. I mean, it's a really surprising find there on the bayou. You're looking around at Saints posters, hunting trophies, and then decorative steins from Munich, and then you're eating a plate of schnitzel and red cabbage.
And this is all year, not just Oktoberfest.
Right, exactly. It's on their menu all year round. But the other thing to know about this place is that at dinner time at night, they do a little more contemporary spin on Louisiana seafood. The flounder that I had there, stuffed flounder, it was actually in a seafood stuffing with the flounder wrapped around it and sort of a spicy Creole sauce over that. So a little different from your sort of down-home neighborhood stuff, too. But talk about different. Go across the bayou a little bit, a little closer to New Orleans, this Restaurant des Familles. Now, this is easily the most upscale restaurant in its zip code, which doesn't seem to be saying much. You're surrounded by swamps and fishing boats.
And you don't have to wear a dinner jacket.
You do not have to wear a dinner jacket. But you wouldn't feel out of place either. This is a nice restaurant. It's really well-maintained. You walk in, it's sort of like this cathedral ceiling of a dining room. You're overlooking Bayou des Familles. You'll easily spot wildlife during the day there. I saw an alligator just like they promised I would. And the menu is more upscale. Oysters Rockefeller, redfish Marcel, which is grilled with crab meat on top and shrimp. It's not exactly like finding that Michelin star restaurant out in the vineyards, but after a day of trooping around the swamps, it seems like a real head spinner of a find to have a wine list and elegant cocktails. So a great find there, Restaurant des Familles. Also Volio's back in the village, Boutis and Jan's for that down-home Cajun food. A lot going on in a place really close to the big city that feels like you've really made it far out into the Louisiana wilds.
Ian, that sounds like so much fun. I'm packing up and heading out right now.
It's always big fun on the bayou, Poppy.
Thanks, Ian. Louisiana Eats rambling reporter Ian McNulty. Bashery native Jared Zarang did not set out in life to become a professional chef and restaurateur. But now, Jared is one of New Orleans' hot young chefs who specializes in showcasing our native ingredients and traditional tastes to their greatest advantage. Jared, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you, Poppy.
So, tell me about growing up in Bashery.
Well, it was pretty country. about as country as you can get. I went to school in Thibodaux, but being in Vacherie kept us far away enough that we could have a rural life. My family was a sugarcane farming family. We raised animals and...
So you grew up really sort of on a farm.
Yes.
And the land that you grew up on has been in your family for generations. When did they first settle there?
I think in the late 1700s.
Wow.
They had that land, and they also had land a little upriver in St. James Parish. The land where our farm is was owned by Bishop Sheck Snyder, which is my grandmother's cousin. He brought Catholicism to the Lafayette region.
Really?
And he's
actually
buried.
Well, he did a pretty good job with that.
Right. He's buried in the floor of the cathedral there.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you grew up in Vacherie, and then you moved away from Vacherie. And tell me what you originally set out to do in life.
Well, I went to school in Baton Rouge for architectural drafting. I've always loved the architecture around Vacherie, South Louisiana architecture. And I thought that I was going to be able to preserve some of those buildings, but I think I was about 20 years too late because most of those buildings have been demolished.
So you were working?
I was working at a firm in Metairie. I did that for 7 years.
As a draftsman?
As a draftsman.
Oh.
Then Katrina hit. That kind of changed my line of work.
And it changed so many of our life direction. It's amazing what a big page turner that was.
It kind of gave us all the wake up call. You know, if you want to do something, then you should just do it.
Yeah.
And
so what did you want to do?
So we had always had dinner parties. One night after drinking probably a little too much wine, we decided that we were going to put a proposal together to take over a space in the French Quarter at Dumain and Dauphine.
To open up a restaurant.
To open up a restaurant. We called it Eat New Orleans. We called it that to celebrate the home cooking of New Orleans and the home cooking of South Louisiana.
Well, that's delicious. And you had no professional training.
I had never worked in a restaurant in any capacity.
And so where'd you get your cooking skills?
Well, when I moved away from home, I wanted the same food that I grew up eating, that my mom and my grandmothers cooked. The only way I could get that is if I either went home mm-hmm. and spent time with them, or if I learned how to cook it myself. So I'd call them and either they'd write down the recipes for me or they'd explain to me how to do it over the phone. I kind of did that dish by dish and learned how to replicate their dishes.
So here we are after Katrina, and you find some like-minded folks, and you decide to open up a restaurant. Tell me about that.
Right. David Smith, my business partner, grew up in the restaurant business. So he decided that if I wanted to do this, if I was serious about it, that he'd show me how to run a restaurant. And he guided me through the first days of Eat and actually, you know, opening Eat. And I had the architectural background, so I renovated it. And he finally had to tell me, okay, it's now time to stop renovating and start cooking.
And when did the restaurant open?
It opened on the Friday of Jazz Fest, the first Jazz Fest after Katrina.
Oh, have you ever heard of Trial by Fire?
That was it.
Wow. What was it like?
Luckily, most Cajun food is cooked very slowly. We worked out the menu so that we prepared half of the menu beforehand.
Because it was pot food.
Because it was pot food. It was gumbo and it was red beans and it was, you know, etouffee and all that. And I got that out of the way ahead of time. And then when it was time to open, it was just the dishes that we had to cook to order. That helped us out somewhat. But it was still, I still block out parts of it,
parts of that first week. You know, it's like childbirth. It's all the same thing. Well, you brought a special treat to show me into the studio today. So what's in that box?
The box is my grandmother's recipes, which, you know, I'm sure most grandmothers, their recipes aren't very organized. But
a lot of them aren't even written down.
Right, exactly. And these are just things that most of the things that I grew up eating that she cooked were not things that are in that box.
Oh.
So I guess she just, you know, did those off the cuff every time.
Oh.
So we found this box of recipes, and some are from her and some are from her brother, who was an amazing cook as well. And my mom brought it up that, you know, maybe I should have the box since she didn't cook anymore. She always says now, you know, she forgot how to cook. You know, she doesn't taste like she used to. My mother and my aunts and uncles make sure that she's fed. And
so what are some of the treasures you found in the box?
I found a crawfish bisque recipe. Yes, which is something that we cook every year, but we've always guessed at how she made it. And I found a recipe on three very small pieces of paper. And it's her recipe for the crawfish bisque.
So how close were you when you looked at what she'd written down?
Well, I think we were pretty close. And we'd always cooked by smell and taste and if the consistency was right and everything. When she's tasted it in the past, she's always approved. But I'm glad to have her actual copy. There's no restaurant that can replicate Grandma's cooking.
No.
At any point.
Well, I just have to tell you that your devotion to preserving and protecting our historic food ways that, you know, there's nothing in the world just about that matters more to me. And it's very inspiring to me. And I am so grateful that I finally wrangled you into the studio to come and talk with us. So thanks for coming.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity.
Chef Jared Zerang of Eat New Orleans and Vacherie Restaurants. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company and Linda Green, the Yakima and Ladies Soul Food Catering. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh and sound engineer Joe Schreiner.
I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.